uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on RadioPower.org, on WhiteRoseSociety.org, also podcasting on Apple's iTunes, and on CRN Digital. Also want to welcome some of our most recent affiliates, KKNS in Missoula, Montana, KSRO in Santa Rosa and San Francisco, California, KTPK in Seattle, Washington, and KRXA in Santa Cruz. Glad to have you all with us. And it is Friday. It is the last day of the week, and it is the day that we always begin our first hour of the program with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is the only independent member of the House of Representatives and the longest serving. He's been reelected 7 times to the House of Representatives, more often than any independent in the history of the House of Representatives. I think of Bernie Sanders as America's congressman, not just as Vermont's congressman, because he really stands for all of us and does a marvelous job of it. Congressman Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you very much for those kind words. Nice to be with you. I'm calling you from a phone in the car. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, that's just fine, Bernie. So hopefully you're not driving.
No, I'm not driving.
Okay, good. All right. Not that I'm trying to play Mother Hen here or anything, but it's anyway, it's great to have you with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. If you would like to talk with Congressman Sanders, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 866-889-8894. And if you'd like to drop into our live chat room and participate that way, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. Bernie, what's on your mind today? What's happening in Congress in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I'm in Burlington, Vermont now. We're on break, of course. The issue that we have been talking about here in Vermont for the last week is the soaring price of oil and the kinds of huge chunks of people's paychecks that are now going out of their pockets into the oil companies, and the real fear about what's going to happen this winter when a lot of elderly people and lower-income people are going to see heating bills that they just it's going to blow them away, and how we address that issue. And one of the concerns that I have, Tom, it gets back to, you know, the discussions that you and I often have about the media, is that when you ask people, why are oil prices soaring, there is in the media almost no connection being made to the fact that the profits of oil companies are going off of the roof. In the last quarter alone, Mobil Exxon saw a $7 billion profit margin. Royal Dutch Shell, I think, had a $5 billion. Marathon is way, way up there. All of the oil companies are making out like bandits, while at the same time, workers are forking over a good part of their paychecks right into the gas tank. And this is an issue, by the way, that the president has been noticeably silent about.
Well, you know, during the election debates, the issue came up, what do you do if there's an oil crisis? And George Bush said during the debate, this is a bad paraphrase of his quote, I don't have it right in front of me, but he said something to the effect of, well, if you have an oil crisis, if you have a problem with oil in the United States, you're definitely going to want me as president because I'm an oil man. I know what to do. And then last week in a White House press briefing, a reporter asked, is there nothing that the federal government can do to help Americans who are feeling it at the pump? And the White House answer was, and I quote, the White House spokesman, the Department of Energy and the EPA have a joint website called fueleconomy.gov. It's the place where people can learn about gas mileage tips. They're giving us gas mileage tips, Bernie.
I mean, it is really pathetic, and it really speaks to the bankruptcy in this of this administration. And it's not just Bush. Cheney is also an oil guy, and they said, elect us because we know a lot about energy, and we can help the American people in that regard. And the end result, of course, is that the profits of the major oil companies are soaring, while old people are not going to be able to keep warm in the wintertime, and working people are spending a fortune for getting to and from work. I introduced, along with Congressman Peter DeFazio of Oregon, just at the end of the session before we adjourned, some strong and I think fairly comprehensive legislation that in fact suggests strongly, tells us what the government can do. And let me mention just some of the provisions that are in that legislation. Number one, we deal with both the short-term crisis of how we lower the price of oil right now and long-term how we make this country much more energy efficient. Short-term, there are several things that we should be doing. Number one, as Bill Clinton did, you can take small amounts of oil out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, which now has about 700 million barrels of oil in it. If you do that and release that oil onto the marketplace, short term, it will drive prices down, and significantly, it will tell the oil industry that the United States government is serious about doing something to protect the needs of working people and those people who heat with oil.
Bernie, if I may interrupt you, I have a question about that. If really what's going on with the incredible spike in gasoline prices is not that it's simply tracking the increase in the cost of oil, but that the, you know, which might have taken gas from, say, $1.60 to $1.90 or something like that, but instead, you know, pushing $3 now, this is simply because the oil companies are making more profit. How would releasing more oil into the market change that? I mean, aren't they just going to continue to price gouge us?
No, I think if you put what it, the experience with Clinton is that when he did that, it resulted in price stabilization. If you put a few million barrels of oil into the marketplace, there will be more oil out there and prices should go down.
So then they can't use the excuse of the high price per barrel of oil any longer.
Precisely.
I see.
Precisely. Okay, that's number one. The second short-term effort that should be made is that the OPEC organization, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, is by definition, their reason for existence is as a cartel to limit production and to artificially raise prices. That's their reason for existence. Now, it just so happens that that is in violation of World Trade Organization free trade law. Now, the president claims to be a great free trader. I am not. He claims to be. So what our legislation does is say, Mr. President, file a formal complaint at the WTO against OPEC, break up that cartel so there is also short-term more oil production. Third thing we should be looking at is a windfall profits tax.
Amen.
If these guys are raking in huge profits far above what their actual cost of production and business are, we should go after them and use that money to help people heat their homes in the wintertime. So our legislation establishes a board to determine what legitimate profit might be and what excessive profits are, and we tax the excessive profits. Long term, of course, what we need to do is move this country in a major way toward energy efficiency, especially in transportation. It is literally beyond comprehension that on average we are driving vehicles today which get worse mileage per gallon than was the case just a few years ago. We are moving in the wrong direction. So what our legislation does is through incentives, through edict, through law, move this country into a situation where our cars will be getting 40, 50 miles a gallon rather than what we're getting right now. So those are some of the things that I think we should be doing. That calls for also increasing CAFE standards, so the cars that are produced in this country get much better mileage per gallon. We talk about giving tax credits to people who are buying cars that get much better mileage per gallon than is currently the case. We should have the federal government purchasing cars and trucks that do a lot better mileage per gallon than is the case right now. So some of those are some of the provisions in that legislation that I think would have the dual impact of A, lowering prices today, and B, breaking our dependence on oil, making us more energy efficient, and in the long run, lowering prices as well.
That's really great. You and Peter DeFazio put that legislation forward.
That's right. Peter introduced it, and I'm the first co-sponsor.
Do you have any Republicans on board?
Not yet. We just introduced it at the very last day that Congress adjourned, but it is an issue that we are going to be working very hard on when we get back. And the other aspect of this whole thing, and what needs to be done immediately, is to substantially increase LIHEAP funding. LIHEAP is the Low-Income Heating Assistance Program, which provides help to millions of lower-income people, many of whom are seniors. Unfortunately, what Bush did is actually, despite the fact that heating prices are soaring, if you can believe it, Bush's budget actually cut back on LIHEAP funding. The Senate and the House have done better. There's going to be a conference committee, but there's no question we need to substantially increase funding for LIHEAP so that nobody in America goes cold this winter.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to have a lot of people in a disaster this winter with these kind of fuel prices, particularly in the northeastern states and the midwestern states. I'm curious if you're familiar with this program that's been proposed about fee baits, where it's a revenue neutral program, which I think is the political appeal of it, where if you buy a vehicle that gets, say, below 30 miles per gallon, for every mile per gallon below 30 that it gets, you pay an additional, say, $100 fee when you buy the vehicle. So if you get a vehicle that gets 25 miles per gallon, you pay a $500 tax on that thing. On the other hand, if you buy a vehicle that gets more than 30 miles per gallon, for every mile per gallon above 30 that it gets, you get a tax credit that you can take off your income taxes at the end of the year, equal to $100 per mile. Now, these numbers are totally arbitrary.
That's in a sense, that's kind of what we are talking about, major tax credits for cars that get serious mileage per gallon.
But are you also penalizing the ones that don't?
Not in our legislation, we're not.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me put a plug in for it. to the extent that I can play lobbyist on this radio show.
The other thing that's really absurd, Tom, is that listeners should know is that over the years, they as taxpayers have provided significant sums of money to the automobile industry. You know why? Their goal was to create energy-efficient cars. And it's pretty pathetic that it ends up being Honda and Toyota that create the first hybrids. The technology is there right now. I mean, we have the capability of having cars at 70, 80 miles per gallon. It is an absolute outrage that Detroit is not doing that.
You know, Bernie, I was living in Vermont. I bought a Honda Insight from the Honda dealer there in Montpelier, and we were able to drive that thing for a couple of years. We traded in on a Toyota Prius because we needed just a back seat, but it was a marvelous car. It got 72 miles per gallon on average, and at the time that we bought that vehicle. In fact, I think it was a few months after we bought it. And by the way, that car had been for sale in Japan for 3 or 4 years before they started selling them in the United States. At the time, the year that we bought that car was the year that the federal government gave $1 billion as a gift, as a grant, to GM, Chrysler, and Ford to develop hybrid technology.
And I was
driving it.
Right. And then you read about guys in their backyards, engineers in their backyards, even improving on these hybrids, getting even more mileage per gallon.
Oh, yeah.
And you're sitting there, and these major corporations are giving us cars to get 17 miles per gallon. And then we're fighting a war in Iraq. People are paying, outrageous prices at the pump. And the President of the United States announces that there's nothing that he can do about it. It is really absurd. And it just speaks to the degree to which this administration is owned by the oil companies and the big auto companies and their willingness to address the major environmental crises or problems facing the middle class. And when we look at the squeeze on the middle class, when we look at the soaring cost of health care, people losing their pensions, add the high cost of oil to that squeeze.
Yeah, and all together you have a real jam. We'll be back with your phone calls. It's Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. He's in Vermont today on the cell phone in his car. And you're calling in. And our regular Brunch with Bernie segment here on Friday afternoon, our telephone number 1-866-889-8894. The Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Marine Corps families here in the suburb of Cleveland had already started a makeshift memorial for the Marines killed Monday when word came more died today.
Insurgents and George Bush coming. Hey, soldiers, you're on your own. This summer, Marines are dying. 14 from Ohio. Gotta get down to it. Soldiers are losing their lives. Should have been home long ago.
In Toronto, Ohio, flags and sorrow line the sidewalk.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. By the way, that clip from Janice, I'm forgetting your last name, but it's chopliverproductions.com. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. And Bernie, let's go right to the telephone lines here. Armin in Florida is on the line. Hey, Armin, welcome to the Tom Hartman program. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie, brother, how you doing?
Good, Armin. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I want to tell you both what's happening here in Sarasota this past week in, I call her Queen Harris District. Catherine Harris that lives in a million-dollar condo, you know, a representative of the people. Anyway, at the first part of the week, there's a story in the Sarasota Herald Tribune about how Walmart is taking a bunch of full-time employees and they're reissuing their work to part-time, and they don't have to pay them health insurance benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And then towards the end of the week, yesterday, there's a nice little story that the public hospital here, why it needs more money, it needs to increase its tax base by 100%, you know, because it's got so many people that don't have health insurance.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, the question I have is, for Christ's sake, or anybody's sake, ask those people up there, Bernie. Will you ask the Republicans and Democrats, how many billions do the Walton family need? How many billions do they need at what expense to the rest of the people in this country? Will you please?
Okay, there you go. Bernie?
All right, Armin raises a very important question. The Walton family, the people who own Walmarts, are worth approximately, if my memory is correct, about $100 billion. If my memory is correct, last year they saw something like a $7 billion increase. And because they are not providing adequate health insurance to their workers, and let's not forget, Walmart is the major employer in the United States of America, the major private sector employer. It means that all over this country, in states and cities, working people are paying higher taxes for Medicaid, Armin mentions the local hospital, for all types of health care for Walmart employees, because Walmart is not doing what it is supposed to do. I don't think working people have got to subsidize the wealthiest family in America, and Armin is exactly right. Some states around the country are beginning to try to address this issue, but it again speaks to the fact that we need a national health care program that guarantees health care to all people. We need a fair tax system which asks the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. Armin's question is an excellent one.
Thank you, Armin, for that call. Bill in Cleveland, Ohio on the line. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. Hey, the subject of a radio show this morning was punishment for the BTK killer. And a light bulb went off, and I thought, you know, as far as all killers, why not give them, you know, life imprisonment without parole, but have them do profitable work and take those profits and pay for their incarceration and also pay for victims of crime? Now, I don't know all the details of how you'd work that out, but doesn't that make a little more sense?
Well, it makes sense in that these people that are really contributing back a little bit to the society for the horrors that they've caused. Yes, it does.
They're already doing that, though, Bernie. In a lot of states, you have people who are working in prison labor, and part of their salary is being confiscated for recompense on their victims. The problem is, though, that you've got some industries that then are facing prison labor as their competitors.
That's right.
There was one here in the Northwest where they were making skidoos, you know, these water things.
That's exactly right, Tom. What you don't want to do is see what amounts to is prison labor competing with American
right,
workers.
Right, so you had a for-profit corporation.
There are ways, I think, you can craft work.
Yeah, ways to get around that, because they had a for-profit corporation going into the prison and saying, cool, we got cheap labor here. That shouldn't be the way it is, but there's got to be a way to make it work. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie's website, by the way, bernie.house.gov or bernie.org. Our phone number, 866-889-8894. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Gold Star mothers, Gold Star dads, left with nothing but a golden flag. Gold Star brothers, sisters too, feel their pain.
And And welcome back. That Country Joe McDonald, formerly of Country Joe and the Fish, his new song, Support the Troops. Welcome back to our program. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And support our sponsors, by the way. This program brought to you by Motor Silk, an extraordinary new technology that saves gas and decreases emissions into the environment. You can find out more about them, Motor Silk, by calling 1-866-LESS-FUEL. 1-866-LESS-FUEL. And Small Dog Electronics. Small Dog Electronics, extraordinary computer products, great prices, wonderful service, one of the finest companies in America, and they deal with all across the United States, 1-800-511-MAX, 1-800-511-MACS. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. We have Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, welcome back to the program. Let's go back to our phone lines here. Christopher in Gordontown, New Jersey on the line. Hey, Christopher, what's up?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I was just curious about the manipulation of an agricultural subsidy to buy big equipment like combines or what have you, and that's being used by people buying large cars like an H2 or an H3 or whatever they call that big Hummer, and an Excursion. These people that are obviously have enough money to buy a big vehicle are getting a tax break for buying that big vehicle.
So they're buying a big vehicle and claiming it's an agricultural equipment?
Here's how it works. I came across this, Bernie, when I first moved to Vermont. Louise and I were living down in Atlanta, and we had a company, we had a small business that we were selling, and it had a profit in it. And my CPA said to me, you've got to buy a car that weighs over 6,000 pounds, because we were going to buy a new car anyway. And he said, if you buy, and you have the business buy it, if you buy a car that weighs over 6,000 pounds, you can take a $17,000 tax deduction. Now, this was 12 years ago. It's now, I think, $100,000. You can take a $17,000 tax deduction because if it weighs over 6,000 pounds, it's not considered a car. It's considered equipment. And this is, as the caller said, this goes back to, it was originally designed for agriculture. And so we went out and looked around. And whereas if you just buy a normal car, you can only deduct $2,000. So we went out and looked around. And lo and behold, the Chevy Suburban weighed 6,010 pounds. The Land Rover weighed 6,004 pounds. I mean, all of these giant SUVs, they're all exactly 5 pounds over 6,000 pounds. Just for that tax break. That's what he's talking about.
Oh, well, that is very, very interesting, and it's something I think we should do something about.
Yeah.
That's absurd.
They refer to it now as the Hummer tax break. Yeah, it's really something. Cindy Sheehan, Rick in Grand Rapids, has some comments on Cindy Sheehan. Hey, Rick, welcome to the program.
Yes, good day, gentlemen. First of all, could I put in a little plug for Bernie? There's an article in Rolling Stone about him and the legislative process he has to go through. I recommend to all the listeners out there, they pick up the issue and read it.
I think, Bernie, you're also on the cover of The Nation this month, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Good on you.
Maybe our next president. Who knows? Anyway, Bernie, I heard something absurd. Of course, we hear a lot of absurdity from the right-wingers on television and on the radio. But Gordon Liddy actually said that because Cindy Sheehan used the word neoconservative to describe the policy in the Middle East that she disapproves of, that is a code word for Jew, and therefore she's anti-Semitic. I wonder if you'd care to comment on that.
No, I can't comment on that because that's just too stupid. I mean,
it really is.
And that is a little bit off the world. Neocon is a word we're not allowed to use anymore.
Yeah, so apparently.
I think even Sean Hannity was a little embarrassed by that comment by Liddy, but I don't know why they bring somebody like that.
I mean, some of these guys are really very, very far off the wall.
Well, yeah. Have a good weekend, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Rick. Good to hear from you. Trevor in Port Lucie, Florida. Port at Lucie, Florida, Trevor?
Port St. Lucie.
Port St. Lucie. Ah, the S became an A. Okay. Hey, Trevor,
yeah.
What's up? You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Well, hi, Tom, and I just wanted to say before I ask my question, congratulations, Congressman Sanders, on your success as an independent politician. It's difficult, and that relates directly to my question. What I was wondering is, you see with all the campaign contributions and the national airtime during elections that really the only people who get any equity are Republicans and Democrats, and obviously that affects an independent's ability to get elected. Is there anything that can be done about that, or can you tell me the reason why independents aren't included in the national debates and stuff like that?
Well, that's a good question. It is, in fact, very difficult for third-party people to be successful in politics. They can't raise the kinds of money. They don't get the kind of airtime that Democrats and Republicans get. In Vermont, we are a small state, and I've been active in Vermont politics for many, many years. I was mayor of the city of Burlington for 8 years, so I became somebody who could not be ignored. You can't ignore the mayor of the largest city in the state. And Vermont is a small enough state that you can go around and talk to tens and tens and tens of thousands of people, and we've had success. I don't have any answer. I mean, I think the broad answer is campaign finance reform, which will end the outrage that currently exists by which big money has so much power over the political life of both parties. And I think we need to move to public funding of elections so that the best candidates will have as much access to the media, as much opportunity to get their points of view out as just people who have a whole lot of money. If we don't do that, what you're going to see more and more is not only the power of big money, but literally people themselves who are multi-zillionaires running for office and self-financing their own campaigns. Direction that we're headed. So I think we need to have fundamental campaign finance reform, let the best ideas prevail rather than the people who have the most money. And that certainly includes independents and people outside of the Democratic and Republican Party.
Thank you, Trevor. Wouldn't one of those parts of that reform also include instant runoff voting, Bernie?
Absolutely, yeah. We're moving on that. The city that I live in, Burlington, Vermont, has passed that. There are some other cities in America that have that. That's an excellent concept, because what it says is you don't have to vote for the lesser of two evils. You can vote your first choice, your second choice, your third choice, your fourth choice. Much more democratic approach.
Yeah, well, and in fact, Australia and New Zealand have been using it for years and works brilliantly there. Tony in Washington, D.C. with us. Hey, Tony, you're live with Congressman Sanders.
Hi, how you doing, gentlemen? And Tom, you are a breath of fresh air in the minutia of misinformation. I just want to tell you that.
Thank you.
Give you your flowers while you're on the air. And Mr. Sanders, hopefully you will be a breath of fresh air when you get your first day in the Senate.
Thank you very much.
You got my prayers. My question is basically, almost being cynical, do you think with all the bad publicity that that the administration is receiving now, is it time for them to let the rabbit out of the hat, i.e. Mr. Bin Laden, so they can say, see what we have now going into the 2006 election? And I'll take my answer off the air, and thank you so much.
That's a cynical question, isn't it? I think the president is, in fact, getting a lot of bad publicity because the American people are beginning to catch up with the disastrous nature of his policies, and even our very, very timid, frightened media is beginning to stand up and take on the administration in important areas. But to answer the question, no, I happen not to believe that Osama bin Laden is being held in captivity and will be released at the opportune moment. I think quite the contrary, because we are in Iraq, because we're spending billions and billions of dollars in Iraq, we are likely making the terrorist situation worse. We are probably fulfilling Osama bin Laden's wish fantasies about what he wanted to see happening. We are creating more terrorists rather than fewer. And it speaks volumes that while we are in Iraq, Osama bin Laden remains free. The guy who murdered 3,000 Americans, that in fact Al-Qaeda is growing stronger. Terrorists are becoming more sophisticated. We're losing more and more troops in Iraq. So that's my thought on that.
Okay. Bob in Missouri is on the line. Bob, welcome. You're live with Congressman Sanders.
Thank you very much, Tom. I want to pat both you and Bernie on the back. You're great guys, and you have my total respect.
Thank
I'm
you.
A truck driver out here holding on by my teeth with these oil prices and what's going on. And basically, Bernie, I've got a question. You know, your electric companies, your water companies and so forth are public utilities. And I'm not in favor of nationalization of companies and so forth, but with what it creates as far as a security problem for this country, why can't the oil companies be put under public utilities and the rates controlled? And
so one of the things, Bob, I mentioned earlier that along with another member, we've introduced legislation that would address, we think, the short-term and the long-term problems. And one of the aspects of the legislation is that it does give the president the power to move aggressively in the midst of a national crisis. We are in the midst of a national crisis. It's not only the truck drivers like yourself are going to be finding it difficult to survive, but the economy is in trouble. Our position in the world is in trouble. Given the fact that we have provided huge amounts of corporate welfare and continue to do so through these oil companies. Do I believe that the government should be able to exert a lot more pressure on these guys in terms of excise, profits taxes, and other efforts to say to them, wait a second, you just can't make as much money as you want while you send this economy into the toilet bowl. So I don't think we should nationalize them, but I do believe that the government should exert a lot more power over them to make sure that the American people are protected.
Thank you, Bernie. Bill in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hey, Bill, welcome.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. Congressman, every time we have these spikes in gas prices, we have these hearings, we have these legislations being proposed, gas goes down 10 cents a gallon, and then we never hear anything again. I heard you mention earlier today, I hear the president mention every day, that we are in a war. Why isn't there any kind of commission like the Truman Commission during World War II that is investigating and starting to use the word war profiteering?
That is an excellent question, and I'm on the Government Reform Committee, and the aspects of the Republican rule in Congress which really distresses me is that you and all of the listeners remember that when Clinton was president, every other day he was investigated for every bloody thing. Couldn't go to the bathroom without an investigation. You don't have those types of investigations. I'm on the committee that's supposed to do it. We don't do it. And, in fact, one of the demands that I will be making to the chairman of that committee is precisely that, just what I've been thinking, is to bring these oil company executives in and to tell us just how come their profits are soaring at exactly the same time that working people are being forced to pay outrageous prices at the pump. That's an excellent suggestion, and that's one that I'm going to act on.
Thank you. Glenn in Tulsa, Oklahoma on the line. Glenn, welcome. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I was watching The Daily Show the other night, and Seymour Hersh was on there talking about sources he had that said there are indications that Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Venezuela might put their heads together and throw us into an oil crisis. And my point is, you know, people say, you know, feel like, well, we won't act until there's a crisis on the horizon, a real one. Well, I think this is the time not to act, not wait until it happens. What do you think?
Well, obviously, there is a crisis right now. I mean, when people go cold in the wintertime, it's a crisis. When the economy is disrupted, it's a crisis. When working people have to spend $500 a year more to get to work to and fro, it's a crisis. The pity of this whole thing and the outrage of what the Bush administration is doing is the technology is there. We can be driving cars to get 50, 70 miles per gallon. We can be moving to hydrogen fuel cells. We can be moving to wind power, to solar power. We can be moving boldly in those directions. And the fact that we are not, the fact that we continue to rely on Mideast oil is beyond comprehension. Not only is this a major economic absurdity, it is clearly an environmental disaster as well. So you're right, there is a crisis, and we have got to act boldly to address it.
Lynn in Eureka, California, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Is that me?
Yeah, it's you.
Oh, okay. I was calling, I was standing out in front of one of the local stores talking to a couple of people. One was a vet. And he was mentioning that he's going to have to start paying more for his prescription drugs. He takes many, many prescription drugs under the, I guess, the Bush administration's policies. But one of the other people that was standing there receives SSI. And she said that she's received a notice that in California, if you're very low income, and I guess most SSI people qualify, the meds are free if you're low enough income. She is now going to have to start, I guess, in January, paying for her meds.
Well, let me comment on the veterans situation. In Vermont, we have worked very, very hard to get many of our veterans onto the VA prescription drug program, which is a pretty good program. Bush wanted to do, in order to, quote-unquote, save money, is to double the costs that veterans had to pay for their prescription drugs from, I think it was $7 to $14 for a three-month prescription. I believe Congress, in fact, has stopped that. So I don't think that that is accurate. But Bush's attitude toward veterans in terms of inadequate funding, in terms of continuing waiting lines, causing, making these folks wait months and months and sometimes years for their benefits, speaks volumes about his quote-unquote love of our soldiers. I am very worried, very worried. In fact, at the end of this program, I'm going to be on the phone with some people in the VA. Very concerned about what happens when our men and women come home from Iraq, because the truth of the matter is the VA now does not have the resources to adequately deal with their needs. And I'm not just talking about amputees or people with brain injuries. I'm talking about the large number of people who are going to come home from the National Guard and from the standing military with post-traumatic stress syndrome. We have got to substantially increase funding for the VA. It really is rather amazing that this president continues to fight through the repeal of the inheritance tax for hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, and yet we can't come up with a few billion dollars to take care of our veterans.
Yeah, it truly is tragic, tragic. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's Brunch with Bernie, our regular Friday afternoon hour with Bernie. Our number 1-866-889-8894. We'll be back with your calls in just a moment. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, Defending America from the Conservative Weapons of Mass Deception.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Through a hole in the air.
Yes, democracy's coming. Welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. It's the our Brunch with Bernie segment, our every Friday segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie, we've got a whole mess of calls here. Let's see how many we can get through. Sly in Arcadia, California on the line. You're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom and Bernie, for bringing these outrages to the attention of the American public. My comments are concerning another outrage, war profiteering in particular. This is from a CBSNews.com article entitled The War on Waste, dated January 29, 2002, and it concerns comments made on September 10th, on the eve of the September 11th attacks, and a quote, "According to some estimates, we cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions," Rumsfeld admitted. "Well, that's $8,000 for every person in the United States. I don't know any family of three that can just afford to throw away $24,000.
Okay, Bernie, your thoughts on that?
There's no question. There's enormous waste within the military. There's whole sums of money that cannot be tracked. No question about it.
Okay, Seth in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Seth, you're live with Congressman Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, there's a lot of things I want to say, but I get, you know, there's a little bit of time. But one thing I wanted to say, you know, I do wish that Bernie Sanders would slip into another party and try to run. He'd be the best thing since Jimmy Carter. My question, you know, since you know, to just do one, is you know, you guys were had mentioned about the post-traumatic syndrome and all that sort of thing. You know, I certainly you know, have mixed feelings on how we've handled things you know, as far as wars go and the past couple of years here. However, you know, the one luxury that the Vietnam veterans didn't have and these Iraqi veterans don't have that the World War II veterans had, you know, like when they interview the guys on the History Channel that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima.
Seth, I'm sorry, we're down to like 30 seconds.
Any skeletons in the closet because they feel like what they did saved the world. And if these soldiers, you know, if we as a country could make these soldiers feel like they really have saved the day, I think it would have a lot better effect, you know, for the rest of the time.
Well, the response to that is that even for those of us who disagree with the war, we know that it's not the men and women in Iraq who are fighting bravely, who are suffering, who caused this war. And they deserve our support. And when they come home, they deserve all of the treatment, all of the help that they and their families can possibly get. We owe them that.
At the very least, yes. Support the troops. It doesn't mean that you necessarily support the policy of the administration.
That's exactly right.
It is entirely possible to support our troops, to honor our troops, to salute our troops, and as so many people around the United States are doing. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie, thanks again for being with us this week.
Good to be with you, Tom.
It is always an honor to have you on the program. Bernie's website, bernie.org or house.bernie.gov. And this is the Tom Hartman radio program. You're in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations.
You You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. So pleased to have you back. Corey Davidson of the Concord Coalition is going to be with us in the studio in just a few moments. But first, our phone number, 1-866-889-8894. Patrick in San Diego on the line. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Well, good morning, Tom. It's a pleasure to speak to you. I've been listening to you for a long time, and I really respect your opinion. I got into a debate sort of with a national talk show host yesterday who called himself a progressive, and he was supporting these armed vigilantes on the border to stop the illegal immigrants. And I think that the way to stop them is to go after the businesses that hire them and, you know, find the businesses. And so they won't have any jobs here, which and it'll also create jobs for Americans. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
I agree with you. And although I would take it to an even larger frame than that, the reason why you have 10% of the population of Mexico in the United States right now and the repatriation of U.S. dollars, labor dollars, to Mexico, now accounting for a larger chunk of Mexico's GDP than their oil revenue, is and that was not the case in 1950, for example, is because in 1950 you had roughly half the jobs in America. You had 25% of the nation's labor force. Actually, 35% of the nation's labor force was unionized. So you had about 70% of the jobs in America were basically union jobs, union-type jobs. And the unions were the first line of defense against illegal immigration. You know, they essentially vetted employees on behalf of the employers, and employers were not able to play these games of hiring illegal aliens, for example, or illegal employees, as the case may be, and doing that. And with the destruction of the labor movement by the Reagan administration and the Bush administration, and then Clinton didn't do much to bring it back, certainly, and now George W. Bush, outright warfare on the labor movement. With the destruction of the labor movement, what you have is that first line of defense against the infiltration into the workplace of illegal aliens is gone. And so my solution would be to say, yes, you absolutely want to make a huge penalty to the employers for hiring these folks, and let's reinstitute tariffs and other international trade policies that bring back to the United States manufacturing jobs, that rebuild our industrial infrastructure, and let's go back to labor policies like we had in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s and the 70s before Reagan declared war on organized labor, that allowed the labor unions to act as partners along with we the people, along with all the rest of us, in keeping our labor force fairly tight and fairly clean. Because, you know, back in the 1950s, it was actually far easier for Mexicans to come in the United States. They could just walk across the border, and they didn't. I mean, there, you know, you had a few, but it wasn't anything like today. And the reason why is because the labor landscape has changed so much.
Yes, thanks a lot, Tom. That's exactly how I feel. Businesses just don't fear, you know, the government doing anything anymore. They just,
yeah.
You know,
absolutely. That's because they run the government. Patrick, thanks for the call. Gary in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Gary, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I can't disagree with you more. I believe Reagan started this downward spiral.
Yeah, absolutely.
I said this to myself a number of times, and I lost track of it. And when you brought it up, it just, you know, the bell went off so quickly, it was unbelievable. He started this acceleration. God rest his soul. You know, whether it was a Democrat, what have you, started it. Ronald Reagan, unfortunately, started this downward spiral in the workplace. We had a lot of, remember the Hardy Party times during the 80s? I think people.
Oh, yeah, and it was all on borrowed money. Reagan was borrowing all that money. You give me $1 million credit card, I'll show you a happy times.
And
Gary,
is
there a question in there? Because I got a guest here I want to get to.
Okay. No, I was just going to say, was it Hubert Humphrey that said this? You would know. The true test of progress is not whether we add more to the abundance of those who have much. It is whether we provide enough for those who have too little.
Yeah, I frankly don't recall if it was Hubert Humphrey or if it was Bobby Kennedy. But
thanks
was,
for your
you know,
time.
Of that era. You're welcome, Gary, and thanks for calling. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Corey Davidson is with us. Corey is with the Concord Coalition. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs with the Concord Coalition. Hey, Corey.
Hey there. How are you today?
Great to have you here in the studio. Thanks for showing up.
Thank you.
The Concord Coalition was founded by Warren Rudman, who some would consider to be a rather extreme Republican, an extremely conservative Republican, let's say, and Paul Tsongas, who the folks on the right would portray as an extremely liberal Democrat. How did these two guys get together, and what was the issue that animated them or motivated them to create something together?
Well, we were formed in 1992, and Paul Tsongas was dropping out of the presidential race after winning the New Hampshire primary. He started to lose repeatedly to a governor named Bill Clinton, and so as he dropped out, and as Senator Rudman was winding down his Senate term in New Hampshire, they got together to talk about some of their shared concerns, and even though it was a Democrat and a Republican sitting down, they were very concerned that the budget deficits had gotten out of control. The atmosphere on Capitol Hill had become more and more partisan. The national debt was getting higher, and the baby boomers were getting older, meaning that Social Security and Medicare would be facing challenges. That was back in 1992, and it sure seems to describe today's situation, too. So we formed a grassroots organization. We have, a very impressive group, a bipartisan group of people on our board, including Paul Volcker, Alan Greenspan's predecessor at the Fed, Robert Rubin, and other former senators.
Who was the former Treasury Secretary.
That's right.
Under
that's
Bill
right.
Clinton.
So it's an impressive board, but the people I really enjoy who work for the Concord Coalition are our 200,000 dues-paying Concord Coalition members and volunteers across the country in every listening area listening to us right now. And they are people who may have different views about the form of government we should have. We have some conservatives, we have some progressives that are all involved, but they all ask the question, what are we handing off to our kids and to our grandkids? And they're all concerned about the fiscal picture, not just 14 years ago when we started, but today, even more so.
Yeah, I think I find it fascinating. During Teddy Roosevelt's time and afterwards, particularly with the Taft administration, when Taft sort of turned his back on Roosevelt, even though Roosevelt had promoted him, had essentially made him president, Teddy Roosevelt was so outraged that he, you know, created a third party out of that. But after the Teddy Roosevelt administration, you had this basically about a 20-25 year period there where the Republican Party flipped the country into fiscal irresponsibility, shall we say, and you had the Democrats screaming about it, and then you had the Great Depression, and FDR goes into deficit spending to try and bring us out of the Great Depression. You had the Republicans screaming about it, and then the Republicans are back in power with Eisenhower, and you got the Democrats talking about deficit spending, and then, you know, the 60s and 70s, the Vietnam War and all that, and particularly LBJ, the Republicans saying the Democrats are the party of tax and spend or the big government or whatever, and really this is not one party's property. You know, on either side, you've got both parties who have at various times been very good about being concerned about fiscal sanity and being very stupid about fiscal behavior, as it were. Right now, it's really at the foot, though, it seems, of the Republicans. Is that accurate to say?
Well, it's not just because I'm on your show. I'd have to say it's accurate. You look at who controls the administration, you look at who controls the House and the Senate, and these deficits that have come back with a vengeance look like they'll be in place for the next decade. So we think both parties have a lot of room for improvement, and that is exactly why the Concord Coalition is here. We don't try to beat up people too much. However, there is a lot of room for improvement right now, and there are areas where the federal government could do a better job to reduce deficits today and to deal with the long-term challenges we face as well.
For example?
Well, you have to go back to the 1980s when those deficits really started to come up, but that would almost be a model for fiscal responsibility compared to today. In the late 80s, we started to impose pay-as-you-go legislation, which means if you passed new tax cuts or new spending, you had to offset it with other kinds of spending cuts or tax increases. You had spending caps that were put in place in the 1990s, and it was really during President Bush 41 and President Clinton during his years that we had fiscal responsibility kind of imposed on the budget process. And as a result, we went from pretty large chronic deficits to actually balancing the budget for a few years there in the late 1990s.
Mm-hmm. And now all that is gone?
It's gone. Few things sunset when it's passed in Washington, but one of the areas that did sunset was the budget laws that helped to pass the pay-as-you-go process, the spending caps. And as a result right now, there is really very little pressure, and there's nothing really put in place to hold the line on spending. And so we see spending go up not just on the conflicts in Afghanistan and Iraq, but across the board, spending has gone way up. And at the same time, there has been tax cut after tax cut after tax cut. And what we've done is structurally we've built in, for instance, last year we brought in $2 trillion in revenue and we spent $2.4 trillion. You had a gap of $412 billion last year. That was the deficit. 1 year, that might not be a problem, but we're doing it year after year to the tune of $5.7 trillion over the next 10 years in our estimate.
And where is this going to lead?
Well, if we don't start to speak up, and I think it's going to be up to us outside of Washington, D.C. to speak up and say that these deficits are not going to work, we're going to be handing off this debt, the interest that we're paying on the debt to our kids and to our grandkids. We really can't afford to do that. It winds up undermining their ability in their working years. And it also winds up putting tremendous challenges on the programs that seniors need today and that they'll need in 10 and 20 and 30 years. Social Security and Medicare are huge parts of the budget, and they are the programs that have pretty massive shortfalls in the long term. We need to deal with those, but before we can even get to those, we've got to deal with this year's budget, next year's budget, and in the medium term.
We're talking with Corey Davidson. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Concord Coalition. The website is concordcoalition.org. Corey, I'd like to play a clip of George Bush talking about his proposed first round of tax cuts, I believe it was, back in 2001. I believe. This might be 2002. Sometimes I mix these two things up. In fact, maybe you'll recognize it and you can correct me. George W. Bush with a proposal that just seemed to me a little screwy.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
How is that possible? If we give $550,000 to every rich person in America, they will create one job. I mean, that $550 billion for 1 million jobs is $550,000 per job. Why not just give $550,000 to each of 1 million poor people? They would spend that money very quickly, and that would create such an economic boom. You wouldn't have to have government creating jobs. You'd have entrepreneurs all over America saying, hey, you know, we'll sell you whatever you want.
Well, we didn't hear that many people back during the tax cut debates 5 years ago bringing up your point, which is an excellent point. How much bang would we get for the buck?
Why did the media ignore this?
$550,000 a job wouldn't work, and I'm not going to disagree with your math. It was that's directly from the mouth of the president there. I think that at the time, we were all so fat and happy, considering that we thought we would have a $5.6 trillion surplus, that everybody thought we had some room for tax cuts. The problem was we didn't leave any room for error. We wound up not having anywhere near that kind of surplus revenue come in. We also had no idea that we were going to have other problems, but we wound up spending and tax cutting our way from a $5.6 trillion surplus to a $5.7 trillion deficit in just the last 5 years. It's an amazing swing, and tax cuts are partly responsible. The director of the Congressional Budget Office, Douglas Holtz Eakin, has talked about how there is definitely a concern about tax cuts. If you are borrowing money to give tax cuts, you wind up having an increased cost of interest costs and things like that. So the taxes actually could go up because of the tax cuts that we've had, because we're borrowing the money. It's not our money. It's borrowed money.
Exactly. They will go up. And, in fact, not only does the money that we borrowed have to be paid back, but the interest on it also has to be paid back. So we have to pay back more than we initially borrowed, just like you buy a house or a car or anything else. Corey Davidson is with us. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Concord Coalition. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this, 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back, my friends. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Our telephone number. We have Corey Davidson with us. He's the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Concord Coalition, a fusion organization of progressives and conservatives who are concerned about the fact that we are spending ourselves into a hole and our grandchildren are going to have to pay for it. Nick in Pittsburgh's on the line. Hey, Nick, welcome to the program.
Hi.
I'd like to know how much the organization that you're representing would like to take on or is willing, going to be willing to take on the amount of corruption right now within the federal government, state governments, and local governments. It seems to me, you know, I'm from Pennsylvania here, and if you know anything about the issue of pay raise here, that's only the tip of the iceberg, I think, to where there's more money being wasted through corruption right now, and they can't, you know, you take here or in Iraq or whatever you want to name, there's just so much that is not accounted for, and there's so few people being held accountable for their actions. But until we get that issue settled, I don't think anything else is really valid or worth talking about.
Okay. You know, my take on this, Corey, is that having worked inside corporate America, been a consultant to at least a half a dozen of the Fortune 500 companies and worked inside their offices, been a vendor to them, that there's a mind-boggling amount of corporate corruption going on out there as well. Money's being wasted all over the place. And that it's one of the rubrics of the right, as it were, more often than not, as in an attempt to destroy government, to simply say, oh, government is corrupt. But what's your take on it?
Well, ours would be, and we deal primarily with the federal government, but, you know, obviously all politics is local. The process right now is flawed, and in some ways it's almost corrupt the way that it operates. You have so many special interest groups on Capitol Hill. I'd say the Concord Coalition is outnumbered 1,000 to 1. We go into offices and we don't ask for money or tax cuts, and everybody else who lobbies Congress does.
Well, there is that corruption.
Everybody
that is
else
mind-boggling.
Wins.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it is.
The lobbying.
We are all getting what we're asking for, and in some ways that's kind of corrupt. I think our kids would consider that corrupt because we're borrowing money from them. So that's one of the ways we look at it. There's no line item in the budget saying fraud, waste, and abuse. It's really hard to find it, but I think constituents across the country have to be vigilant. I'm slightly familiar with the situation there in Pennsylvania, and we have a very good Concord Coalition chapter in Pittsburgh, by the way, and I encourage people to be involved you know, at the local level, but also at the federal level to look at these issues as well.
ConcordCoalition.org is the website. Diana in Santa Rosa Beach, Florida on the line. Hey, Diana.
Hi. I would like to see everybody write their senators. I've just written mine. I'd like to see a Truman Committee empowered in the Senate again, like Senator Truman did in 41.
Okay. To look into war profiteering, are you talking about? That's what Truman was looking at.
War profiteering. It was one of the most productive committees in the history of the Senate.
Yeah, and through,
he stayed
through
on
a lot of people in
44.
Jail. Yeah. Yeah, and then he became president as a result of Diana. Okay, good point. Do you think that there'll be a Truman Commission to look into these kind in war profiteering, these kind of things?
Well, I'm not sure, but one of the most audacious panel forums I participated in ever, maybe, was somebody who was boasting that we'd be able to pay for the Iraq war through oil profits, and that was just such a wrong-headed thing for somebody else to say. It was pretty easy to take on at the time. There are tremendous costs that are not even being acknowledged in terms of the budget process right now that are adding to the deficit, and that's just on the fiscal side of the ledger. I mean, obviously, you also have human costs, and we need to watch that and the long-term costs. I think we need to do that today for tomorrow's sake.
Okay, we have about 30 seconds left. Ann in Sarasota, Florida has a question for you. Hey, Ann.
Hi. My question kind of is, are you also doing things on a state level? Because, like, I'm in Florida, and the number of people that have gone on welfare, collecting from the state, it's just been increasing astronomically because there just aren't the jobs out there for them that pay enough to support themselves. And so we're not only getting federal debt piling up there, but state debt, local debt.
Right.
And I was wondering what you're doing with that.
Well, we stay at the federal level, but, you know, if you see Social Security fraud, waste, and abuse, they have offices that are very good at dealing with that. I encourage you to stay active. If you know of specific instances, let your contacts know, your state representatives, your U.S.
I
senators.
I think beyond that, perhaps Ann's point was just that, hey, you know, the Bush economy is killing us, and the cost of government is increasing, and we're not doing anything about it. Corey Davidson, it is ConcordCoalition.org. Thanks, Corey, for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. In just a moment, we're going to get into our best of the rest of the news segment. First, George in West Palm Beach is on the line. Hey, George, thanks for calling. 1-866-889-8894. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. How you doing? Appreciate being able to talk to you.
Sure.
I really appreciate your probe and how you give insightful facts and don't get on rants and, you know, like a lot of the talk hosts do. They just start ranting around about this and that.
You know, but George, you talk like that, no radio station will ever carry this show. You're supposed to either talk about fishing or be yelling obscenities at people.
Right, I know. Well, none of us need that. It's not healthy. It doesn't help anybody. But what I wondered is, if you have such a good way with words and explaining things, if you could shed some light on this, it seems like endless struggle there is in the world between conservative versus progressive thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves economics, religions, the environment. Yeah. It's like conservatives don't want to look at the facts.
There's a fundamental difference in worldview, George, and this has been pointed out a number of times over the years. Over the centuries, actually. Yeah. You can go back to Sir Edmund Burke, who was the father of modern conservative thought in the 1770s, and his long debate with Thomas Paine. And I actually wrote about this in the book review I did of Thomas Paine's one of Paine's books that you'll find over at BuzzFlash.com. And Burke was of the opinion, as most conservatives are, that the essential nature of people is evil, and therefore you need a strong governmental force or a strong religious force in order to constrain them from acting out their natural evil instincts. And progressives, liberals historically, Thomas Paine, for example, believed that the essential nature of people is good, and that the purpose of government is to help people achieve their highest goals on the one hand, and express that goodness, and on the other hand, when there are those among us who are dangerous, who are pathological, who are damaged, to heal them to the extent that it's possible, and if not, if they can't be healed, then to isolate them from society in a way that they can't harm society, in other words, to put them in jail. And that fundamental cleavage is really the thing that is at the core of conservative versus liberal. It's the reason why conservatives define morality as what you do in private, what you do in your bedroom, what people do with between each other, what drugs they're taking, what kind of sex they're having, what position they're having it in, with whom they're having it. Whereas liberals and progressives define morality as what we do in the public arena. You know, are there hungry people among us? Are there homeless people among us? Are there people who are sick among us who are not being cared for? The classic liberal thought comes from Jesus, but Jesus expressed it really well in Matthew 25 and in the Sermon on the Mount. Classic conservative thought in many regards comes from Moses and the Sermon on the Mount, although you'll find both conservative and liberal variations in both Judaism and Christianity. But that's the fundamental cleavage, George, and out of that comes everything else. Really fundamentally everything else. And it's a very large topic that we can talk about some other time, but thanks for bringing it up. I appreciate it. It's good to hear from you. Rob Call is with us with opednews.com, and Jeff Milchen is with us with reclaimdemocracy.org, two great websites. Reclaimdemocracy.org, one of the finest websites out there committed to literally reclaiming democracy in the United States. opednews.com, one of the best news sites out there, the aggregators of news, what's going on in the world, as well as aggregators of op-ed pieces, those op-ed news, that you'll find. So I want to welcome you both. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Glad to have you here. And Rob, great to have you here.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
Yeah, I'm very, very pleased that you're able to show up. Jeff, what's on your radar right now? What do you, for our best of the rest of the news segment here, what do you see as, out of this past week, the biggest news events, or the recent past, the biggest news events that we should be concerned about in the context of democracy in America?
Well, as usual these days, there's plenty on the negative side, but one I thought I'd point out on the positive side, and this is something that originally appeared in the Los Angeles Times, but right on our homepage in our editor's pick section, folks could check out this article. There's been, of course, an ongoing campaign to raise this idea of junk lawsuits clogging the system and how we need to strip rights away from citizens to sue companies because it's adding costs and so forth. But in fact, one of the most obvious forms of junk lawsuits are what are known as slap suits,
sure,
strategic lawsuits against public participation, where corporations sue citizens to basically shut them up and prevent them from raising a stink about practices they object to.
And very often the way these things happen is somebody will go to a public hearing where, you know, shall we site a waste incinerator in our town or shall we allow Walmart into our town or whatever, and not to pick on Walmart, you know, big box store, let's say. And they'll stand up and speak out, and the next thing they know, they're being sued. You know, just a guy who happened to live in the neighborhood.
Right. And so this goes on a routine basis without any meaningful punishment. But earlier this week, on Monday in Los Angeles, a judge actually fined a law firm that was filing a slap suit against citizen activists and against employees of the Forest Service, fined them over $200,000 for filing a lawsuit that had absolutely no merit. Citizens were objecting to genuine concerns about a proposed luxury condominium development on Big Bear Lake in the Southern California mountains. And the judge actually took action and punished them. So if we want to take care of problems with junk lawsuits, well, this is a great example of a way to go about it. So, you know, spreading that story with some positive reinforcement, and along with that story on our website, there's a link that goes into more depth about how corporations are the leading filers of junk lawsuits. That'd be a great way to kind of turn the tide on that message being spread by the corporate propaganda mills.
Yeah, and the reality is that when Republicans, conservatives, there's a few Democrats in on this as well, particularly the DLC bunch, that when Republicans and conservative Democrats, and when conservatives talk about junk lawsuits, they very much are not talking about corporations suing people. They're talking about people suing corporations. That's code for individuals suing corporations because they've been harmed. And they really have no problem with the kind of junk lawsuits that these describe. And this is one of the reasons why it's such a big deal that more than half of the judges right now sitting on federal courts have been appointed by George W. Bush, because for the last 3 years of the Clinton administration, the Republicans blocked most of Clinton's attempts to appoint people to federal judgeships. So there were all these vacancies when Bush came into office, and he just filled them like crazy. And do you know who, you know, the genesis of this particular judge?
I actually know nothing about the background of the judge on this. But one interesting added note, the law firm is a giant national firm, Foley & Lardner, with offices around the country, and they state in the article that they're planning to appeal this. So we decided to put their San Diego office's phone number on our website so folks could let them know what they think about plans to appeal the case and cost taxpayers additional tens of thousands of dollars in court costs.
Interesting, and that would be at ReclaimDemocracy.org.
Right.
Rob Call at opednews.com. Rob, what do you see? What's flying by your desk there, or your website, your computer? What do you see as the biggest news of the last week as it regards to democracy in America?
The biggest news has been Cindy Sheehan down in Crawford. But what I think we have to do now that she's going home to deal with her mom's stroke is we've got to spread it from just Bush being the problem with the war to the Republicans in the right wing, and we've got to pile the responsibility on there. That's why the article that I posted today is that the rubber stamp Republicans are killing our GIs. We've got to get that message out. It's not just Bush. It's all the people behind him who have taken over the Congress that are doing that. So that's one. Another I want to talk about is Charles Schumer. Charles Schumer has been bragging that he's going to pick who the candidates are.
Who the candidates for what are?
For the 2006 elections. He's going to pick the Senate candidates. He's going to pick the congressional candidates. And that's not the way democracy works.
Well, Schumer's part of the DNC, or DLC, is he not?
Yeah.
The Democratic Leadership Council?
You know, it's like him and Hillary Clinton. What are they going to decide who everybody?
Well, that's the DLC's plan. The DLC, had control essentially of the Democratic Party for most of the Clinton presidency, and that's why today, when you ask average people what does the Democratic Party stand for, they say I don't have any idea, because the DLC's values, by and large, are the values of the traditional Republican Party, and the progressive values, the liberal values, the things like, you know, we're in favor of organized labor, we're in favor of clean environment, we're in favor of a higher minimum wage, we're in favor of national health care, we're in favor of corporations having less power and people having more power. Those are not the DLC positions. Those are the progressive and slash liberal positions. And there's a war going on inside the Democratic Party for the heart and soul of that party. And what you're suggesting is that Chuck Schumer has risen up and said, hey, I'm in charge now.
Yes. Now, I think that...
So what do we do?
The good news is that all those people who got energized to go out and support an alternative to Bush, what was his name? Oh, Kerry, I think it was.
Yeah. Well, Kerry, you know, is, I got to say, Rob, Kerry is not all that bad. I mean, Kerry, I don't know, is Kerry DLC?
I think so.
Yeah, you know, I didn't think so.
You know,
I don't
remember, I'm in a state where Schumer put his biggest footprint deciding that Bob Casey was going to run when I'm supporting a real progressive in Pennsylvania, Chuck Finocchio.
Yeah, I understand that. But, the best of my knowledge, John Kerry has never officially affiliated himself with the DLC, whereas a lot of people like Evan Bayh, for example, proudly do.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if Hillary has officially... Well, actually, Hillary Clinton has officially positioned herself with them.
She's on the DLC front page right now as one of their big people.
Right.
I want to mention two other details. One, we've got November local elections coming up. We're in the final stretch on that. Now's the time where you can support local candidates who can really make a difference in deciding how things happen. And another thing that's happening now is we're in the final stretch of the HABA funding at the state and county level, where counties are
making... This is the Help America Vote Act, where we give federal money to states to give to private for-profit corporations to supply voting machines.
Exactly. So I'm involved at our county level in looking at how the county, which is, our county is run by Republicans, they're saying that we have to get rid of our Lieber machines, which Rebecca Mercuri says are much, much more reliable. They're old, but they're fixable and maintainable. They're much more trustworthy than these computerized ones that people can control from afar. And we're fighting to not take the HABA money because there's no good alternatives yet. And in this state, it's crazy. For example, one computerized machine has been approved in the state, but only without paper ballots, without paper records. It's just nuts. Now, Rush Holt has a new piece of legislation that hardly any Republicans are getting on, even though this should be a nonpartisan issue, reliable voting. There's that new voting report that came out that's going around that's supposedly fraudulent, that's blaming all the problems in the 2004 election on Democrats. Crazy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is. And my concern with some of Rush Holt's, particularly his earlier bill, is that it may just add the assumption of safety to these corporate machines. I don't think the corporations should be involved in handling our vote, period. End of discussion.
The last thing I want to mention is we have a lot of stuff on Op-Ed News that, because I think it's really important. I have a lot of progressive Christian born-agains who are writing from that perspective. If you know somebody...
Yeah, we had one of them on the program yesterday.
Yeah, you had Anthony Wade on yesterday. Yeah. He's been great. I think what we're providing is articles that you can send to the people you love who are born-agains who are driving you crazy. And these are, they give a clear perspective from a progressive perspective on how to look at Bush, how to look at the politics that fits within that their way of looking at things.
Okay, great. Jeff Milchen, what do you see coming down the road here? We've got a week in the weeks and months coming up. What do you see as the big issues coming down the road?
Well, just to add on to the talk about the Help America Vote Act, actually the lead feature on our website right now is about going a step beyond reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act and strengthening existing policy to address the fundamental need to establish a constitutional right to vote, and the fact that our lack of, despite the widespread perception that that is a constitutionally guaranteed right, the Supreme Court has made clear that it doesn't consider it that.
In Bush v. Gore.
Yeah, as recently as 2000. And Representative Jesse Jackson Jr. of Chicago, in fact, has a resolution in the House to establish a constitutional right to vote. And that's one of the truly positive actions that folks can take, is really work on spreading awareness of that need, getting their local U.S. representative to sign on board as a sponsor. Last time I checked, we were just short of 60 co-sponsors on that bill.
That's marvelous.
So check that out right at the top of our homepage and learn more about that.
At reclaimdemocracy.org.
Right.
And Tom, something just popped up on our website. You know, so we've got a team of people putting up news now. One is this John Roberts business with affirmative action and how he's really talked against women's rights. And another is Powell's aide has said that it was the lowest point of his life when Powell gave his UN speech about WMDs.
Oh, that's interesting. The aid to Paul. Jeff, you were in the middle of a sentence. You want to finish that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, just as far as your question about looking forward to the weeks ahead and upcoming fall elections at the local level, I think, you know, while we, of course, need to work on continuing to get better people in office, I think one of the great problems is there's been a tendency for progressives to jump from election to election and focus far too much on who's getting elected. And there's a continual lack of attention to how people get elected.
Yeah, and this
when
is
we change the rules about how people get elected, we're going to get more of the same. So
yeah.
Really just want to make that point that, of course, there needs to be attention going to the elections, but even more importantly, to changing the way we go about them, revoking the power of money to control the outcomes.
To the process. Okay, and that's at reclaimdemocracy.org. Rob, we got about a half a minute left. The hot news stuff on opednews.com.
I think I've covered it. One other topic I wanted to cover was broadband free Wi-Fi. Verizon just announced, according to Newsweek, that they're not going to be putting broadband into the rural areas. Broadband and Wi-Fi and access to the Internet is the way that people who are progressive people want to get the whole news.
Yeah. Yeah.
They can't get it through this radio or TV except through you and the same people like you.
Right. We've got to build the commons. And, Rob, next time we get you on, you got to be on something other than a cell phone. That just doesn't work. I'm sorry. Rob Call with opednews.com and Jeff Milchen with reclaimdemocracy.org. Two great websites. Check them out. Thank you, gentlemen, for being on our program today. It's the Tom Hartman Show, 10 minutes before the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now you love me as a loser, but now you're worried that I just might win. You know the way to stop me, but you don't have the discipline.
Leonard Cohen. He is one of the most brilliant poets there ever was, and a pretty decent singer, too. Welcome back. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Interesting, in our chat room, Bobby says, if you go to, if you send an email to braindead@whitehouse.gov, it gets to Bush. Could it be? Bobby, are you serious? I don't know. Steeler77 is talking about cannabis beer. Maybe that's what Bobby's been into. Anyhow, you want to drop into our chat room and say hi, you can get there by going to www.tomhartman.com and click the live chat button or link, and it'll take you right there. Jesse in Pittsburgh on the line. Hey, Jesse, what's on your mind today?
I'm curious if you caught Senator Hagel, Republican senator, of course, on CNN last night. He was speaking against the war.
I did not, but I read a transcript of it this morning.
Yeah, it was great because he was talking about how the White House is disconnected from reality and losing the war, and he even mocked Cheney. When Cheney was saying the insurgency is in its last throw, it was great to hear a Republican senator say, you know, if that's winning, then he's got a different definition of winning.
You know, broadly, I agree with you. I wrote an article about Chuck Hagel 2 years ago in which I pointed out that he had worked for George Bush Sr. for many years in Washington, D.C. He was brought to Nebraska to be the CEO of an election of a voting machine company, which is now known as ES&S. They sold those machines to the entire state of Nebraska. He then left his job, told the people that he was an investment banker, didn't reveal that he had been the president of a voting machine company, ran for the United States Senate as a Republican, won on his own voting machines in districts like black districts that had never before voted Republican, swept the state. And the Washington Post called it the upset victory of the year for the whole nation. And then immediately, and it got a whole, and got Republican control of the legislature, and the Republicans then immediately passed a law saying that you couldn't audit the vote in the state of Nebraska. And Charlie Matulka, the guy who ran against him 6 years later, the Democrat, says, you know, he's been fixing elections. And I've had some concerns about Chuck Hagel ever since then, frankly.
Oh, you have? Oh, okay. If you check out the catch up what he said about CNN, though. It was good to hear him say that they're...
Yeah, I mean, it's great to hear a Republican saying that, but I've been saying for 2 years, Chuck Hagel...
Well, I completely agree, yeah.
Since he comes out, since he was the CEO of a voting machine company, he's
exactly.
the guy that is going to run for president next, I guarantee you.
Yeah.
And he's positioning himself for a run for president, and I just found it a little spooky that the guy who is the president of the voting machine company that counts most of the votes in America is going to be running for president.
Oh, amen. I didn't know that he was running for president. Okay,
he will be. He's not. He has not come out yet, but you mark my word. He will be. That's why he's saying these things. Jesse, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. But I agree with you. It is nice to hear a Republican actually say, hey, Bush is nuts. Well, that's not exactly what he said, but you can kind of get it. He's figured out which way the wind's blowing.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. It is 7 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, now it's 7 minutes after the hour. Actually, there's a 5 second delay in there too. So now it's 7 minutes after the hour. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. I want to get into, and our website, TomHartman.com, of course, if you want to drop into our live chat room or participate in our message blog. I want to get into the issue that Jeff Milchen raised in the last hour from ReclaimDemocracy.org about slap suits and lawsuits and tort reform and lawsuit abuse, and share with you some absolutely eye-popping, mind-boggling stories. But before we do that, Brian in Grand Rapids had a question. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Taking my call. I just first wanted to say that I think that you have the greatest radio program in the nation right now, and you are just a wonderful talk show host.
Well, thank you, Brian.
My question is, this is actually from a couple of weeks ago when you were talking with Congressman Sanders, and somehow this said the conversation had turned to the possible impeachment of Bush, and he mm-hmm. had suggested that maybe impeachment wasn't the best option for anyone. And I was wondering, is there any way that you could reiterate what he was talking about?
Sure. I can't speak for Bernie, but I can tell you my understanding of the two sides of the argument from a progressive point of view. Okay,
mm-hmm.
Let's have what's best for the Democrats, what's best for the Greens, what's best for the progressives, on the pro-impeachment side, there's the notion that power accretes. Power over time gradually accumulates, and that's one of the reasons why it's absolutely insane that the Democrats are pursuing a let's keep our powder dry policy with regard to judicial nominees, with regard to fights in the House and the Senate. I mean, this is the thing that Newt Gingrich absolutely understood. You fight every fight. And even when you lose a fight, you still get your message out there. There are some, one more person is going to hear your message. It's the old P.T. Barnum thing about there's no such thing as bad publicity as long as they spell my name right. And if you fight every fight over and over and over again, then slowly you accumulate more and more people who are with you on the fight, who get at what you're saying, who understand what you're saying. And therefore, even if you lose the fights, even if they're futile fights to begin with, at least you've made your point. You've gotten your talking points out there. You've gotten your message out there. People go, yeah, I'm with them. Yeah. And it rallies people around. And there is an absolute truth to that. And some folks on the let's impeach Bush side, even knowing that it's impossible to get him impeached right now with Republicans controlling the House and the Senate. In fact, it's impossible to even get a bill of impeachment to the floor of the House to be voted on, much less to have a positive vote on it in the House. And of course, impeachment is in the legislative sense is the same thing as an indictment in a judicial sense. The impeachment doesn't actually remove him from office. Bill Clinton was impeached. He was indicted, but then he was not convicted. The impeachment happens in the House. The House determines whether or not there's a crime, and then the Senate determines whether or not this crime was actually committed by this person in a way that's worthy of removing them from office. The Senate chose not to remove Bill Clinton. The House chose to impeach him. So anyhow, the folks who are saying, let's try to impeach Bush are saying, you know, it's important simply to have a forum to air his crimes. The lies that George Bush has told, the damage that he's done to this country, the way that he has divided us, the way that he's harmed our economy, the way he has harmed our troops, the way he has harmed our reputation around the world, the way he has not made the United States safer, the way he's making our air dirtier, the way he's selling out to corporations, the timber interests, to the mining interests, you know, to the drug companies, to the big insurance industries. He is destroying the commons and the infrastructure of the United States on behalf of corporations. And an impeachment attempt, even if it didn't get to an impeachment proceeding, would be a good way to make those visible. And that's a strong argument. The other side's argument, the other side of the progressive don't impeach Bush argument, which is the side I think that Bernie subscribes to, although, you know, again, as I said, I can't speak for Bernie and I wouldn't want to try. But my understanding from how he answered the question is that probably this is where he stands, is that there are some really important issues before us right now. We need to be talking to the American people about things like, you know, the state of labor in the United States, about our trade policies, about, you know, about economic issues, about the fact that we're, like we heard from our Concord Coalition guest, that we haven't had any tax cuts under George W. Bush. All we've had is deferred tax increases. We have borrowed money from our children and grandchildren in order to give cuts, in order to give cash to wealthy people in America and call it tax cuts. And these are, and not to mention the war and not to mention our standing, all of these things are really serious issues. And rather than just trashing George Bush, what we need to do is we need to be getting active. We need to be standing up and saying, okay, here is a plan to take care of this. Here's a plan to take care of that. Like Bernie just introduced this legislation along with Peter DeFazio. As I recall, it was about our trade policy. It is essential that we move forward on these things, and that once the House gets into an impeachment frenzy, if that should happen even, let's say the Democrats actually take the House in the 2006 elections, if the House gets into an impeachment frenzy, there's going to be no juice, you know, no energy left. There's going to be no time left for anything else. The Republicans, when they were impeaching Bill Clinton, really didn't get much done. And what it did was it turned a lot of Americans against those Republicans, and it harmed them in many ways. And although it did put on hold Bill Clinton's ability to do more damage to the United States, or to, from the point of view of the Republicans, Bill Clinton's ability to advance his legislative agenda. And in the context of George W. Bush, it may put on hold his ability to do more damage to the United States, the point that I meant to make. But that, you know, hey, there's more important things for us to be doing right now. So those are the two sides of that one. Does that make sense?
It does, and thank you very much, and keep fighting the good fight.
Okay, thanks a lot, Brian. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from you. Yeah, this is... And I can argue either side. You know, it's like, I have to say, I could really argue either side. And if the Democrats take the House in 2006, and I think that there's a chance that they may, we have seen now that there has been a substantial flip in the, what do you call it, the position? The political standing of 19 now out of 31 states, out of 30, there are 31 so-called red states in America. Of course, there are no red states. There is not one state in the United States where every single person is a Bush supporter. Not one. So you got a bunch of purple states. But Bush, being a divider, not a uniter, has advanced the idea that there's red states and blue states. And so to use his dividing verbiage, there are 31 red states, he says. Well, now, 19 out of those 31, which leaves, what, 12? 19 out of the 31 states, red states, have flipped blue. Alaska went for Bush. Now, 49% of Alaskans disapprove of Bush, only 46% approve of him. Arizona went for Bush. Now, 52% disapprove of him, only 45% approve of him. Arkansas went for Bush, now 56% disapprove of him, only 40% approve of him. Colorado had voted for Bush, now only 45% approve of him, a fully 53% disapprove of George W. Bush. In Florida, the percentage of people in Florida who would not vote for Bush, who don't like the job, he's 53%, only 44% are on his side. These are the states that went for him. Georgia, 51% disapprove, 47% approve. In Indiana, only 48% approve of him. In Iowa, only 42% approve of him. 55% disapprove of him. In Kansas, only 46%. Kentucky, 42%. Louisiana, 48%. In Missouri, he's down to 38%. Missouri is very much a swing state. I mean, this is the state where John Ashcroft lost an election against a dead guy. Mel Carnahan died in a plane accident that was almost identical in circumstance and nature to that that killed Paul Wellstone. Both of them to this day, by the way, nobody's figured out what happened. So here you have Missouri now, 38% say that Bush is doing a decent job. This is a state that he carried. Nevada down to 40%, New Mexico 40%, North Carolina 47%, Ohio 37%, South Carolina 45%, South Dakota 45%, Tennessee 43%, Virginia 42%, West Virginia 45%. The guy's in the tank. So... we'll see how it plays out. I got to tell you, I want to get into these stories, these urban legends. This is from the Los Angeles Times earlier this week, and I think this is a huge story, and most Americans don't know about this. Now here's the story, and then I'll tell you the story behind the story. The story that's out there, and many of you have probably gotten emails that have this story in them because it's been flying all over the internet, particularly in conservative circles. Merv Grzesinski set his Winnebago on cruise control, slipped away from the world from the wheel, and went back to fix a cup of coffee. You can guess what happened next. The rudderless, driverless Winnebago crashed. Grzesinski blamed the manufacturer for not warning him that if he did this if he put it on cruise control and went in the back to make a cup of coffee, it might crash. He sued and won $1.75 million. There's only one problem with the story. It's a fabrication. There is no Merv Grzesinski. Winnebago is... This story has gotten such mileage that Winnebago, the company, has one of their people pretty much full-time devoted to answering emails and phone calls from people wanting to know what happened to Merv. Besides this, there's the mythical case of Amber Carson in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who got into an argument with her boyfriend in a restaurant, threw a drink at him, and then broke her tailbone when she slipped on the wet spot on the floor. Naturally, Carson sued and won $113,500. Sounds outrageous? It is, because it never happened. But the cons are sending emails around telling you about this. Then there's Kara Walton, a Delaware woman so eager to avoid a $3.50 cover charge that she tried sneaking into a nightclub through a bathroom window but fell and lost a couple of teeth. She sued the nightclub and won $12,000 plus payment of dental bills. No, sorry, never happened. But the Grzesinski story, the Carson story, and the Walton story, these three stories that I just shared with you, have been cited by CNN, U.S. News and World Report, the American Spectator, the Oakland Tribune, the Fort Worth Star-Telegraph, the Desert News of Salt Lake City, the Akron-Beekman Journal, the Greensboro, North Carolina News and Record, the Augustus, Georgia Chronicle, on and on it goes. Newspapers all across America carrying these stories that they've gotten by email from conservatives. These are collectively referred to as Stellas. Stellas. Why Stella? Because of Stella Liebeck. Stella Liebeck is the 79-year-old woman who had McDonald's, who was burned by McDonald's coffee. And I got to tell you, her true story, right after this break. This will blow your mind. It's 20 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. This is the place where smart people get their news. Speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here, you are in the center of the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year.
And welcome back.
With the blood in the ink of the headline and the sound of the crowd in my ear.
You tell them, Jackson Brown.
You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interests run.
And welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And sometimes gratification doesn't come instantly. I'm going to postpone my Stella story for just a moment and ask Greg Gorman with the Talk Radio News Service to fill us in on what's going on in Washington, D.C. We'll get back to Stella in just a minute. Hey, Greg.
Hello, Tom. I'm gonna stay online afterwards. I want to hear the Stella story myself.
Yeah,
whatever it is, it sounds interesting.
Okay.
We should be talking about Senator Hagel and the White House.
You mean former voting machine company CEO Hagel?
That's right. Well, exactly. So the White House is going to have to deal with this in the next few days. Especially, we heard this morning from the Pentagon that Iraqi troops are not being trained, and there's a lot of confusion over the amount of troops that are being trained in Iraq. We've heard from Senator Biden in the last few weeks that the numbers don't match up between what the Pentagon is saying and what people on the ground are saying about the number of troops that are being trained in Iraq that can actually do the job that we're doing. Now the White House has to deal with probably Senator Hagel saying, we need a troop withdrawal, we need our troops out, we need to train these Iraqi troops. Senator Feingold, who is a Democrat from Wisconsin, has already said this. However, if Senator Hagel, who is a Republican, says this, the White House may have the first inklings of trouble that they're going to have to figure out why the president has not come up with an exit strategy.
Wait a second. This is their first inkling of trouble, Greg?
Well, it'll be the first inkling of trouble from the Republicans, because at this point, except for Senator McCain, if Senator Hagel comes out and says this, he's going to give voice to a lot of people who are waiting for someone in a position of leadership to have to say, why is there no exit strategy? So maybe inkling isn't the first word,
yeah,
or you know, the right word. Maybe this is first indication.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I said, it hasn't happened yet, so we don't know. But
it's
Senator
the first
Hagel
slap upside the head here. It's the first slap upside the head.
Well, okay.
So, I mean, these
You're
guys
are a little rougher than I am, but that's fine. But you know, Ian, you know, we should be clear. It has not happened yet. Senator Hagel has not actually made this statement. He's the leading contender right now. Mm-hmm. If there is a Republican, he and Senator McCain to come out against the president.
Yeah. Yeah, it's what's happened is there's blood in the water. These guys,
there's blood in the water. That's
yeah,
it.
These guys get it that George Bush is a wounded president. He's not only is he a lame duck, but he's a hated lame duck. I mean, there are people across America who don't just dislike him. It's not just that they've kind of tuned out. It's not that they think, you know, maybe he shouldn't, you know, keep his sex life to himself or something like that. I mean, this is nothing like the way people felt about Clinton. We're talking about people hating him the way that they hated LBJ and that they hated Richard Nixon for lying to us about matters that have to do with the death of our children.
Well, it's funny that you mention LBJ, because one of the stories that I just read was talking about what happened whenever LBJ finally had to withdraw from the 1968 race because someone from his own party turned against Vietnam.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's what the White House is really going to be worried about, because if Senator Hagel comes out and or Senator McCain, he's going to have a Republican of his own party. We all saw what happened when Senator Dr. Frist went against stem cell research.
Yep.
It was a wound for the president. This is his major issue, this war. He won on the war. It was Bush versus Bush in the election. This war got him reelected. If someone from his own party finally turns on him.
Yeah.
And now
we read in Capitol Hill Blue that after Bill Frist came out against stem cells, that Bush was raging around the White House, screaming obscenities and throwing things, and, you know, regularly shouts at people, screams them out of his office, screaming obscenities at them, that he is out of control, that they're adding weather forecasts to the internal documents about, you know, stormy weather, you know, or sunny skies, depending on what his mood is that day.
Well,
Greg Gorman,
it's gonna get worse.
Greg Gorman, thanks a lot.
rigorously exploring the truth of the day. Here's Tom Hartman.
People try to put us to death.
Talking about my generation.
Just because we get around.
Yes, indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Well, now I'm rethinking that. I remember back then. Welcome back. Oh, my goodness. Louise over there laughing, too. Welcome back to our program. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-888-9894. Our telephone number, the place where smart people get their news. Okay, I was telling you about the Stella Awards. Just very quickly, I first told you about Merv Grzinski, who set his Winnebago on cruise control, went back to make a cup of coffee as the thing was hurtling down the highway at 70 miles an hour. When it crashed, he sued Winnebago for not having put in their instruction manual that he shouldn't put the thing on cruise control and go make a cup of coffee. It never happened. It was a made-up story. The story of Amber Carlson of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, who got into an argument with her boyfriend at a bar, threw a drink at him, and then slipped on the very wet spot on the floor that she had created, hurt herself and sued the bar. That never happened. But another one about Kara Walton, Delaware woman, who tried to sneak into a nightclub through a bathroom window, fell into the bathroom, smashed out a couple of teeth, sued successfully. Again, never happened. Never happened. All of these stories been covered by CNN, U.S. News and World Report, on and on it goes, as if they actually did happen. Okay, these are the urban legends that are promoted by the Reich. Now, the Reich would also have you believe that Stella Liebig, the 79-year-old woman who had the hot coffee lawsuit against McDonald's, was also a frivolous lawsuit. In fact, very often, when Stella is mentioned, it's in the context of these other phony ones. According to popular accounts, this is from the Los Angeles Times, according to popular accounts of the lawsuit, Liebig's coaxed nearly $3 million from an Albuquerque jury in 1994 after being scalded by McDonald's coffee she spilled on herself while riding in the car. Now, there are a few facts missing from this. Trial testimony showed that at 180 to 190 degrees, McDonald's coffee was much hotter than that served by other restaurants or by people in their homes. The fast food chain had received at least 700 complaints about hot coffee in the previous decade and had paid more than $500,000 in settlements, according to trial testimony cited in the Wall Street Journal. Liebig's injuries were hardly minor. In spilling this coffee on herself, she suffered third-degree burns. Now, first degree is where it gets red. Second degree is where it bubbles and blisters. Third degree is where the tissue actually blackens, where the skin is actually destroyed. She suffered third-degree burns on her thighs and groin area, was hospitalized for a week, and had to undergo painful skin grafts. Before filing the lawsuit, she wrote a letter to McDonald's, a 79-year-old lady, sweet little lady. She wrote a letter to McDonald's asking that they lower the temperature of their coffee and pay for her medical bills because she was uninsured. It was $20,000 that she owed the hospital for the skin grafts and the hospitalization from McDonald's coffee. She simply said to them, would you please, you know, so this doesn't happen to other people, please reduce the temperature of your coffee, and would you please pay for my hospital bills? It'll be about $20,000. McDonald's offer her $800. At that point, she decided to sue. But first she said, let's go to mediation. Let's try and work this out. And so a mediator looked at her case, looked at McDonald's, somebody in the middle, and suggested the McDonald's pay a settlement of $225,000. McDonald's refused. So when it went to jury, the jury awarded her $160,000 in compensatory damages, you know, medical expenses, loss of time, loss of work, all that kind of stuff, and $2.7 million in punitive damages. That is punishing the company. In other words, we're gonna punish you, McDonald's, so that you won't do this to anybody else. That's the whole point of punitive damages, to prevent the harm to others. In fact, one of the jurors told the Wall Street Journal, quote, the facts were so overwhelming against the company, their callous disregard was very upsetting. And then after the verdict, the judge in the trial slashed the punitive damages from $2.7 million down to $480,000. And yet this case and these other complete fabrications have been used to justify so-called tort reform. The stuff that John Roberts is like the champion of, the corporate lawyer, John Roberts. So that you or I, we the people, if we are harmed by a corporation, we can't sue. And yet, as Jeff Milchin pointed out, and you can learn all about by going to reclaimdemocracy.org, most of the frivolous lawsuits filed in the United States are by corporations against individuals to get them to shut up. And there is no legislation pending to stop those. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, Mike in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Okay. Quick thing. I've worked for numerous, quote, plaintiff's attorneys and have gone into the meat of many of these cases. And people really don't understand what's going on out there. They really don't. The one that comes to mind most readily is this one poor soul who was going to the hospital for a hernia operation. However, he was an alcoholic, and he was on antabuse at the time, and it was in his records.
On antabuse is a drug that if you take it and then you drink alcohol, you become violently ill, and so it prevents alcoholics from drinking.
Correct. And it makes you essentially allergic to alcohol.
Right.
For all intents and purposes.
Right.
And so he went into the operating room, and the intravenous anesthetic that they used was alcohol-based.
Oh, boy.
This man died because virtually his entire internal organs dissolved. And, we wonder.
Now, George Bush would say, all he can sue for is a quarter, all his family can get is $250,000, because that's all a human life is worth, unless he had an income over $250,000. You realize the lawsuit, the tort reform that the Bush administration proposed and that has been passed already in a number of states, says that you can sue for a maximum of $250,000 or your annual income multiplied by a certain number of years. So
correct.
if you're one of these people who makes $10 million a year over a 10-year period, that's $100 million, then you can sue if you were this guy for $100 million. But if you're a guy who works and who makes $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year, and you know that's less than $250,000, then the most you can sue for is $250,000. It's basically the tort reform, the lawsuit reform. What it does is it allows multimillionaires and billionaires to sue and get millions and billions, and therefore they are treated very differently when they go into hospitals and things. You know, it's like, look out, this is a guy who can actually sue us, versus the middle class of America who have an absolute cap of $250,000 in those states where this law has been passed, like Texas and California, as opposed to, and now, of course, these guys are trying to make it federal.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the problem of it is people don't seem to understand that when you're talking about, let's say, a child who was born and through egregious errors on part of the obstetrician, that child is going to be a basket case the entire rest of his life, however long he or she lives.
Right. It's going to cost a heck of a lot more than $250,000 to keep them alive. Mike, I get it, and thank you very much for sharing it with us. I appreciate the call. It's Freeman in the Republic of Claremont, the People's Republic of Claremont, California, on the line. Hey, Freeman.
Howdy. I was wondering, I looked up your source in the L.A. Times. I think it was a great rant. I liked it. And I'm curious what your source is for blaming the Reich wing for populating these emails.
Well, I can tell you, first of all, I'm on the email lists for both left-wing groups and right-wing groups. I have never, ever, from any of the left-wing groups, gotten an email that talked about tort reform or lawsuit abuse that quoted any of these stories. I've gotten many of them from the right-wing groups, number one, particularly when tort reform was active about a year and a half ago before Congress. I mean, you know, I was getting three and four a day from these different groups. And so, you know, that. And it is the Republicans in Congress and the so-called conservatives, and it's not just Republicans, by the way, there's conservative Democrats, particularly the DLC Democrats out there, who are advancing this so-called tort reform, who are using these kinds of stories to advance their agenda.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Thanks. Great. Thanks a lot, Freeman. Good to hear from you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Jeff in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. I'm in Amarillo. I'm heading down toward, Crawford.
Amarillo, Texas. So you're Jeff from Boulder, who's in Amarillo.
I'm Crawford bound.
Okay, Crawford bound, going down to see the folks at Camp Casey.
Especially with Cindy having gone now, I think it's really important to support the group that remains, and so I'm going down there to do my part.
That's great. I congratulate you for that, Jeff. I think that that's absolutely marvelous.
And I understand that Crawford has a really mean chef salad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what Guy James was telling us about, that he went in there and he asked for a chef salad, and they immediately said, "You're not from here, are you?" Okay, well, Jeff, good on you. Good luck and safe journey. God be with you. And give us a call when you get down there. Let us know how it is.
I'll call you on Monday.
Great. I look forward to it. Thank you very much, Jeff. I have a letter, by the way, here from Perry Jeffries, a first sergeant, USA retired, who wrote a letter, an open letter, to Larry Northern. Larry Northern is the president of Northern Real Estate in Waco, Texas, Northern Realtors. And is the guy who put the pipe on the back of his pickup truck and drove over the crosses on the road in Crawford, Texas, and wiped out some 500-600 of the 800 crosses that are there. Drove over American flags and got his truck stuck because one of the crosses got stuck up in his transmission. And so that's how we figured out who he was. And so Perry Jeffries, Sergeant Perry Jeffries, wrote this letter to Mr. Larry Northern, the guy who drove the pickup truck to destroy the crosses. And he says, "Mr. Northern, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War, having served with the 4th Infantry Division on the initial invasion with Force Package 1. While I was in Iraq, a very good friend of mine, Christopher Kutchel, was killed in an unarmored Humvee outside of Baghdad. He was a cavalry scout serving with a 3rd ID. Once he had declined the award of a medal because soldiers assigned to him did not receive similar awards that he had recommended. He left 2 sons and a wonderful wife. On Monday night, August 16th, you ran down the memorial cross erected for him by Arlington West. Mr. Northern, one of my soldiers in Iraq was Roger Turner. We gave Roger a hard time because he always wore all his protective equipment, including 3 pairs of glasses or goggles. He did this because he wanted to make sure that he returned home to his family. He rode a bicycle to work every day to make sure that he was able to save enough money on his army salary to send his son to college. At Camp Anaconda, where the squadron briefly stayed, a rocket landed inside a tent, sending a piece of debris or a fragment into him and killing him. Mr. Turner, on Monday night, August 16th, you ran down the memorial cross erected for Roger Turner by Arlington West. Mr. Turner, one of my soldiers was Harry Bacon. Harry was one of the finest men I ever met. He was in perfect shape for a man over 40, working hard at night. He told me that he did that because he didn't have much money to buy nice things for his wife, who he loved so much. So he had to be in good shape for her. He was like a father to many young men in his section of maintenance mechanics. They fixed our vehicles with almost no support and fabricated parts and made repairs that kept our squadron rolling on the longest, fastest armor advance ever made under fire. He was so very proud of his son-in-law, who married the beautiful daughter so well raised by him, by Henry Bacon. His son-in-law was a helicopter pilot with the 1st Cavalry Division, who died last year in Iraq. Henry stopped to rescue a vehicle belonging to another unit on what was to be his last day in Iraq. He could have kept on rolling. He was headed to Kuwait after a year's tour, but he stopped. He could have sent others to do the work, but he was on the ground, leading by example, when he was killed, too. On Monday night, August 16th, Mr. Northern, you took it upon yourself to go out in the country, where a peaceful group was exercising their constitutional rights and harming no one. And you ran down the memorial cross erected for Henry and for his son-in-law by Arlington West. Mr. Northern, I know little about Cindy Sheehan except that she is a grieving mother, a gentle soul, and wants to bring harm to no one. I know little about you except that you found your way to Crawford on Monday night in August with chains and a pipe attached to your truck for the sole purpose of dishonoring a memorial erected for my friends and lost soldiers and hundreds of others who served this nation when they were called. I find it disheartening that good people like these have died so that people like you can threaten a mother who lost a child with your actions. I hope that you are ashamed of yourself. Sincerely, Perry Jeffries, 1st Sergeant, USA, retired. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. Amy in San Diego. Hey, Amy, we only have half a minute here. I'm sorry. What's up?
Okay. I just wanted to add something really quick to that McDonald's story that I always like to tell people when they talk about this.
Sure.
I have a friend that is in the health department, and he says that they purposely turn the water up that high so they don't have to clean out their machines.
Right. It prevents bacteria from growing.
Right, right. Yeah. I didn't know if you had said that, so I just wanted
I didn't say it because at trial it wasn't, to the best of my knowledge, it wasn't determined that there was any reason why they did it. But,
yeah.
You know, it's common knowledge in the industry that
they're trying to get them to have a temperature that it can't be any higher than a certain temperature.
Right, yeah.
Thanks, Tom.
And they did it because it saved money, ultimately.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
Amy, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, I don't think so.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
We were born before the wind. Also younger than the sun.
Van Morrison.
Yeah, the bonnie boat was won as we sail into the mystic.
What a beautiful song.
I can now hear the sailors cry. Smell the sea and feel the sky. Let your soul and spirit fly into the mystic.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. The website, tomhartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room or post on our message board. Fair and slightly unbalanced radio. Right, Marcia? Hey, Alice in Eureka, California is on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello, Tom.
Hi, Alice.
I'm now learning that Supreme Court nominee Roberts was hearing an important case involving the White House and prisoner abuse. Judge Roberts ruled in favor of the White House, and then he got the nomination for the Supreme Court.
Well, to make it even more, I don't know if complicated is the right word, more Machiavellian or weird or wrong, Alice, he had actually been interviewed by the White House and told that he had a possibility of becoming a Supreme Court justice before that case, before he ruled on that case. And then the White House came before his court and said, we would like to have the right to say that these human beings have no human rights. They have no human rights under the Geneva Convention. They have no human rights under U.S. law. And Judge Roberts, 4 days before Bush nominated him, but after Bush had interviewed him, said, okay, I'll go along with the administration on this. That makes it even more outrageous, don't you think, Alice?
Yeah.
It really does. Alice, you are one of our treasures. 91 years old, you're still sharp as a tack and sharing wonderful stories with us every time you call. I thank you so much for calling.
Oh, yeah. Have a good day.
Thank you, Alice. You too. And it's always great to hear from Alice in Eureka, California. It's great. Dave in Eureka was telling us how he went to the candlelight vigil Wednesday night, and people were saying, where is Alice? In fact, I should have mentioned that to her while she was still on the phone. Although, if you're listening, Alice, maybe you already heard the story. So thank you for the call. Thanks to Louise for producing our show this week. Thanks to the folks in our chat room for showing up. Thanks to our sponsors, particularly Small Dog Electronics, has been with us for a couple of years now. Motor Silk, our new sponsor, has got a great product, evergreenamerica.com. You can check it out. Our 1-866-LESS-FUEL. Thanks to our callers. Thanks to those of you who called in. Thanks to those of you who are listening. Thanks to the affiliate, our affiliate radio stations all across the country who carry this program. And if I did, I think I said thanks to the folks in our chat room, but I want to double it up again. It's always great to hang out with you folks, men and women who come in there every day and have just some of the finest conversations on the Internet. We'll see you all next week. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.